One at their Circles of Support office, located across from Treasure Bay Printing on Northeast 4th Street in Grand Rapids. They also offer a food pantry from 11 to 2, Monday through Thursday. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library continue their Brown Bag Author Series Monday, February 2nd at noon. Local author Jim Roloffs will talk about his latest book, Buddy, a true story of a friend who persevered through cerebral palsy and poverty. Feel free to bring your own lunch or enjoy the light refreshments provided. The Headwaters Quilt Guild meets Tuesday, February 3rd at 6 p.m. at a Stitch in Time in downtown Bemidji. All are welcome. Listen to the Season Watch Pod with host Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. Season Watch is for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. Tune in Saturday at 1:30 and Sunday morning at 10:30. The City of Brainerd Parks and Recreation Department invites you to a skating party Saturday, February 7th from 1 to 4 at Memorial Park. Enjoy music and free snacks and drinks. They'll have skates available to borrow and helpers for beginners.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar was rushed as she spoke last night during a town hall meeting in Minneapolis. A man used a syringe to spray a liquid on her. He was tackled and arrested. After a pause to be checked out, Omar continued speaking. Her office says she is okay. A preliminary government assessment is out about the fatal shooting of Minneapolis protester Alex Preddy last weekend. NPR's Jimena Bustillo reports it contradicts the Trump administration's initial narrative of the shooting.
The review describes how Alex Preddy resisted arrest before two officers shot him, but the review makes no mention of Alex Preddy attacking officers or threatening them with a weapon, as the administration first described the incident. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem has come under intense bipartisan scrutiny for her initial characterization. She was quick to describe Preddy's actions as, quote, domestic terrorism, saying Preddy was attacking officers first and brandishing a weapon. The review does not mention an attack or that a weapon was brandished. Instead, it notes officers noticed a gun once there was already a struggle to arrest him. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News.
President Trump gave remarks in Iowa yesterday. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben says he was trying to turn the focus to the U.S. economy.
You really got the feeling that he was trying to talk about something new after federal officers shot and killed those two people in Minneapolis. Trump's tone last night was pretty typical for him. He was just trying to sell the economy as mega strong. But data contradicts Trump's message here. I mean, inflation has cooled, but it's still elevated, and the job market appears to be slowing. And importantly, Americans don't feel that the economy is doing well. Trump's approval on the economy is double-digit negative right now.
NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben reporting. More than 400,000 customers lack power from Mississippi to Tennessee. That follows the deadly winter storm over the weekend that killed dozens of people. Residents of Nashville, Tennessee are trying to stay warm without power. From member station WPLN, Cynthia Abrams reports many are now worried about their water supplies.
There are two main water concerns after a winter storm like this one. There's worry about pipes freezing, which is why residents are advised to drip their faucets. Now that temperatures are beginning to rise, this becomes less of a risk. But it poses a different danger, says Nashville's Water Services Director Scott Potter.
The bad news is we're going to start seeing more main break activity as the ground begins to thaw.
When the ground begins to defrost, the soil and underground pipes can shift. That can cause those pipes to break, which can cause water outages. Water main breaks can be identified by pooling water in the streets. For NPR News, I'm Cynthia Abrams in Nashville.
You're listening to NPR. South Carolina is reporting 789 confirmed measles cases. This surpasses last year's outbreak in West Texas, where two school children died. NPR's Maria Godoy reports.
Public health officials in South Carolina have reported 89 new confirmed measles cases since last Friday. The vast majority are in unvaccinated kids and teens. The outbreak is centered in Spartanburg County, where the vaccination rate among students is 90% overall. That's lower than the 95% threshold needed to prevent measles outbreaks. There are currently 20 people in isolation and 557 others in quarantine. That includes students in at least 19 elementary, middle, and high schools in the northwest region of the state, known as the Upstate. Officials say at least 18 people, both adults and children, have been hospitalized with complications from measles since the outbreak began in October. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
French President Emmanuel Macron is hosting the leaders of Denmark and Greenland today. The Danish leader says the U.S. and Europe need to stick together on Arctic security. President Trump has demanded control of Greenland, he says, for national security. The Danish leader says the world order as we know it is over. She says she doesn't think it will return. A research group estimates casualties from the war in Ukraine could be nearly 2 million this spring. That's at least 1.2 million Russian troop deaths, wounded or missing, and half that number from Ukraine. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, celebrating a century of supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org/100.
It's where we pull up a chair to one of our members' kitchen tables. We get to know them a little bit better.
Good morning.
So, why do you listen to KEXE, KBXE?
Because it is the best radio station I have ever found. I don't remember when I started listening to it, probably 20 years ago. And you have science, phenology, which I love. You are kind people. You respect everyone. You are always on the side of those who need help. I just wish I could clone you and take you all over the world. I've been wanting to say this for years, and I tell everybody I know to tune in. You know, you're the kind of people that make the world a good place. Friends, coming back in style.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Federal authorities revised their claims about how they killed an American. Officials initially called an ICU nurse in Minneapolis a, quote, domestic terrorist and would-be assassin. Now that video and other information contradicts that, a preliminary report says something else. The report says what Minnesotans were doing on that street Saturday morning before the video footage that many Americans have seen. According to the government, two women were standing on the street. That's it. Standing on the street. Alex Preti was not one of them. Allegedly, the women refused to move, though video shows otherwise. Agents approached. They claim Preti resisted arrest, and after somebody shouted gun, two agents repeatedly shot him. That's the latest account from the Department of Homeland Security. In a moment, we'll hear from a former secretary of that department. We begin in Minneapolis with NPR's Meg Anderson.
At the intersection where Alex Preti died, the grief of this community is palpable. This street is normally a place where people gather to celebrate the diversity of Minneapolis. There's a halal market, a banh mi store, a German beer garden. But people here now are standing quietly in the road. The street has become a makeshift memorial. It's filled with flowers, candles, and signs. One reads, "We will carry on your work, Alex." People barely raise their voices above a whisper.
See peace and sorrow, hope and sadness all at once.
Joel Reese made a pilgrimage to the site for the first time on Tuesday, like so many fellow Minnesotans, to feel
a sense of connection to others, a sense of hope, a sense of how we're going to move forward, how we can get ICE out of Minnesota.
That sentiment to get immigration officers out of the state is what so many Minnesotans are still saying.
Play your job!
Go home! Please!
No one wants you here!
You losers!
A few miles south by the airport, outside the Whipple Federal Building in Minneapolis, protesters boo and jeer every time a car, most of them with masked drivers, leaves this concrete, brutalist building. This is headquarters for the operation here in Minneapolis, which is why KS is here, heavily bundled against the cold.
Blood has been shed here. People are angered here. We are not going to stop until they have left, until ICE in general throughout the country has stepped aside, because it's not just happening in Minnesota, it's happening all over the country.
KS asked NPR to only use her initials because she works for the state and is worried about retaliation from the federal government. But the strained relationship between the state and federal officials seems like it's improving. In a statement, Governor Tim Walz said yesterday that he spoke with Border Czar Tom Homan, who is now in charge here. They agreed to work together toward investigating the two killings of citizens in Minnesota, both Preddy's and the January 7th killing of Renee Macklin Good. Walz also said he and Homan would work toward a, quote, swift and significant reduction in the number of federal forces in the state. But it's not clear whether the number of agents will decrease enough for the situation to change.
I'll believe what I see it, basically, when it comes to what this means.
Julie Prokish and their partner Meg Voiles are set back from the main protest.
We have a van and we've got snacks, so.
A lot of snacks.
They've been at the Whipple Building protest every day for almost a week, overseeing a table of donated supplies.
It's exhausting, and yet at the same time, it's also exhausting not doing anything.
Same. Like, it's really hard. I'm a project manager for work, and it's hard to just hold a meeting and not know if one of your team members is going to get abducted the next day.
And the situation is still tense here. Last night in the city, Democratic U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar was speaking at a town hall when a man tried to attack her, brandishing a syringe. He managed to spray a substance on her before he was tackled by security. Omar later said she was okay. She continued her town hall and said she would not be intimidated, a sentiment being felt a lot these days in Minnesota. Meg Anderson, NPR News, Minneapolis.
We wanted to hear another perspective on how DHS operates or could operate with someone with deep knowledge. That's Jay Johnson. He served as Secretary of Homeland Security in the Obama administration, and he's with us now. Good morning, Mr. Secretary. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
So the first thing I just wanted to ask you, as a person who led that department, when you watch the many videos of immigration enforcement actions in Minnesota, but also elsewhere, what do you see?
Frankly, I see a force that I used to lead that is now ill-trained, hot-tempered, undisciplined, that has lost its way. The Department of Homeland Security was created, as you know, in the wake of 9/11 to keep Americans safe from the videos. And videos don't always accurately portray what is going on in its entirety in a community. But what I see, what appears to be the case, is thousands of DHS personnel as an occupying force in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And when you put such a large force like that in military-like apparel, mask, there are bound to be confrontations. It's bound to inflame people, agitate people, and it's tragic. Renee Good and Alex Preddy did not have to die, but it's almost inevitable in these kinds of circumstances.
So let's dig into a couple of things that you said here. I want to remind people, though, the Obama administration deported more than 3 million people across both his terms, more than any other president in U.S. history. There were people who objected. There were people who criticized loudly. And yet those actions didn't trigger the kind of chaos and deadly shootings by federal agents like we've seen in Minneapolis today. What was different?
So an effective immigration enforcement policy, and I'm not saying we had it perfect in the Obama administration, but there are dual, seemingly conflicting objectives. One is a secure border. Americans want a secure border. If you go to Laredo, Texas, which is like 80% Mexican American, they want a secure border. And I believe Americans are entitled to a secure border. My second year in office as secretary, we had one of the lowest numbers of illegal boarding crossings in like 20 years. So a secure border is one objective. Another objective is focus on the criminals who are undocumented for reasons of public safety, while trying to treat in a fair and humane manner those who have been here for 20 years undocumented, committed no crimes, want to get on the books, want to be accountable, give them an opportunity. So President Obama created DACA in 2012 for childhood arrivals, as you may recall. Mm-hmm. And so those are twin objectives, seemingly in conflict, but that has to be the overall goal of an effective immigration policy. And what I used to say to our enforcement removal operations personnel, Tom Homan included, is when you're out on the streets in a big city like Minneapolis or Chicago or New York, use your common sense. One notorious incident, dragging a grandmother off church steps or pulling a kid out of school, can derail your entire mission in a community by agitating the population there. And we're unfortunately seeing that in spades right now in Minneapolis.
To that end, you presided over DHS after a big hiring surge for Border Patrol officers. So you mentioned training. Is this about training and onboarding, or is this about the political leadership and the direction that they've been given?
I suspect it's all of the above. You know, across law enforcement, Michelle, whether it's Border Patrol, ICE, the FBI, New York City Police Department, there has to be training and tactics of de-escalation, learning how to de-escalate a conflict rather than see it escalate into something lethal. You know, Renee Good died over how she parked her car on a street. George Floyd, 6 years ago, died over an argument that began with a counterfeit $20 bill. Eric Garner in New York City, 2014, died through a chokehold in an argument that started over a carton of cigarettes. Mm-hmm. So tactics in de-escalation are so important to de-escalate a situation, let tempers lower before an unnecessary death occurs. There's been a surge in hiring lately at DHS among ICE personnel, CBP, and I worry that in the effort to plus up, we may not be adequately training new people who are coming on board to learn how to be effective law enforcement officers.
You work with Tom Homan when you were leading DHS. Will sending Homan to Minnesota make a difference there?
I believe that it will. My educated speculation is that the president sent him there to try to calm things down. I worked with Tom when he was head of enforcement and removal operations at ICE during the Obama administration. He was a career senior civil servant at the time. And without a doubt, Tom's pro-enforcement. But, you know, to come at an effective immigration policy, I also had the benefit of people who reflected the activist point of view from the left at my conference table. And so you really do have to be able to balance all sides and hear all sides in this very, very difficult, sensitive issue.
That is Jay Johnson. He was Homeland Security Secretary in the Obama administration. Mr. Johnson, thanks so much for sharing these insights with us.
Thank you.
I do want to mention that we have asked current DHS and White House officials to join us for an interview. We've repeatedly asked, and those invitations remain open. This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. In just a bit, I'll be joined by Jennifer Barr, and we'll be your hosts for the morning show until 9 o'clock, before we hand things over to Kari Hedlund for Headwaters. Grand Rapids Tax Aid is offering free tax preparation February 2nd through April 12th by appointment only. For more information, call 218-245-9202. The Bemidji Senior Center has a book sale Tuesday, February 3rd, beginning at 10 a.m. They will also have their monthly writing class at 1 p.m. that day. Learn how to capture your memories. Tamarack Water Alliance meets on Zoom Wednesday, February 4th at 10 a.m. Leanna Goose will speak on freshwater protections and her work with the Rise and Repair Alliance. Register at tamarackwateralliance.org. The open closet at Zion Lutheran Church in Grand Rapids is in need of clothing donations, especially in men's sizes. Gently used clothing is accepted, as well as new socks and underwear. The 20th annual Back to Basics Sustainable Living event is Saturday, February 7th at Pine River Backus School. The morning keynote with the forager chef, Alan Burjo, and vendor fare are free and require no registration. But if you'd like to participate in workshops, register and find more info at happydancingturtle.org. Now for more Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com. From Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. From Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at progressivecommercial.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The estate of Kurt Vonnegut joined a lawsuit against banning his most famous book. Slaughterhouse-Five is about a World War II veteran like Vonnegut himself.
Listen, Billy Pilgrim has come unstuck in time.
That's Vonnegut reading his book about a man who keeps flashing back and forth from his memories of the war to the present.
Billy has gone to sleep, a senile widower, and awakened on his wedding day. He's walked through a door in 1955 and come out another one in 1941.
This novel has sold millions of copies, has provoked a long-running debate about the firebombing of Dresden in World War II, and has run afoul of a Utah law. It includes references to sex or sexual organs. Book banning debates are common across the country, so we will hear from a critic and supporter of Utah's law. We begin with Kurt Vonnegut's daughter, Nanette, who remembers the typewriter clacking as her father wrote Slaughterhouse-Five.
We knew not to bother him. He was talking to himself a lot.
And then he let her read the story, which is serious and comic all at once.
And I have to say, when I was reading, he would be in the next room. If I laughed, he'd come running in. Because that is what mattered.
He'd want to know which joke landed.
Absolutely, every time.
The book has been banned in various places for decades, sometimes even burned. Now, two Utah school districts have removed it from their libraries. If a third makes a final decision to remove it, the ban goes statewide. Nanette Vonnegut and the Vonnegut Estate joined the suit along with several living authors whose books are also affected.
I feel the urgency. I've never felt this urgency before about what's going on. Maybe because I have a granddaughter. I don't want to see her in a world where words are taken away from her and choices.
Utah's legislature passed the law on sexual material in 2022. Terry Hutchinson of Utah has no doubt about their wisdom.
Certain types of sexual material put in school libraries is harmful to students. It's harmful to student safety.
Hutchinson is a Utah lawyer, broadcaster, former local school board member, and current candidate for the State Board of Education. He says he's also a fan of books. For many years, he reviewed them on a Utah radio station.
Hi, everyone. I'm Terry Hutchinson. Welcome to Bookmarks. It's been more than 25 years since I first began talking about Harry Potter on this program.
He likes J.K. Rowling and books related to his faith and history and classics.
I'm actually in the middle of Homer's Odyssey again.
But when he was on a school board in southwest Utah, the board sometimes pulled a book from the library. At our request, he went back through Vonnegut's masterpiece.
You know, I read Slaughterhouse 5 years ago.
Got it.
I am not a big Kurt Vonnegut fan. Not really because of subject matter, but because of style.
If you were on a school board today, and the question came up as to whether to remove this book from a school library, what would you do?
It'd have to come out.
To the extent that you're comfortable, which passages go over the line for you?
Oh.
He said a phrase from the book describing a partially aroused man.
And once you get there, that is where you are crossing the line.
Now, here's a conflict at the center of the lawsuit. Utah law allows schools to remove sexual content when it's challenged, but the U.S. Constitution upholds free speech and expression. A U.S. Supreme Court case has limited when a government may censor alleged obscenity. Officials must consider not only a few words in the book, but whether it has wider literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. Terry Hutchinson is hoping the courts will overlook that in the case of Utah school libraries.
You've got 10 and 11-year-olds, and then you've got kindergartners who are just starting out.
I could see a case with a 17-year-old, though, that person is still a minor, but learning to become a citizen, learning about the world, and some of them will reach into a library and get value out of a challenging novel, even including some material that I wouldn't necessarily agree with myself.
And the point is, you have public libraries for that.
Hutchinson once was on the board of a public library, which also removed books sometimes, although he says it had a broader standard. In a school library, he says, parents may object on behalf of their kids. Let me ask about the other example. What about a parent who insists, I want my child to have available in the school library, which is the most convenient library for them, a variety of literary works, including ones that might be on the edge of controversial?
If it violates the standard, then it's not our obligation to put it in the school library. We're using taxpayer funds.
Yeah, but what if the taxpayer is saying, I want that?
Doesn't matter. I mean, heck, parents might want a pony. Does the school district have to provide the pony? And I'm being a little facetious there, okay?
What if the parents want My Little Pony, the book? No, that's a joke. That's
then,
a joke.
Then,
please continue.
You know what? If it's in the budget, whatever.
On the other side of the argument, Kurt Vonnegut's daughter, Nanette, says removing her father's novel from the school library takes it farther from the audience that needs it most.
It's robbing these teenagers of these magnificent words. Shutting books down, taking them away from kids is a very disturbing and awful thing that's happening.
I think it will sometimes be said, we are not actually banning the book. We are taking the book out of reach of children under a certain age in public schools.
I don't know how they can justify it. There's nothing pornographic. Can't kids at this age decide for themselves and also let the teachers and the librarians do their work?
Oh, right there is an even deeper conflict over who decides. Vonnegut wants professionals to decide, not politicians. Terry Hutchinson feels the opposite.
I think it's just naive to say, well, politicians should stay out of the library. Politicians should stay out of the schools. And a lot of people naively thought that for years, until eventually, all of a sudden, kids are coming home with different ideologies than the parents want or whatever.
Nanette Vonnegut contends her father's book teaches no ideology except to be kind. She told me the book has saved people. What did you mean?
Saved the lives of especially teenagers. I think it's a very lonely place to be, very awkward place to be. I think his tone, his voice, his words, he's made people feel less alienated, less alone.
Vonnegut is arguing for the artistic value of the book, one of the factors the courts may consider as they decide who decides. This is NPR News.
For jazz singer and musician Michael Mayo, jazz is about curiosity, self-expression, and freedom.
A lot of the things that we value in this music are things that, like, I think that we kind of should value as humans, yeah, as, like, civilizations.
Hear the conversation with first-time Grammy nominee Michael Mayo on All Things Considered from NPR News. Ta-da!
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and I'll be here until 9 o'clock. Then we're going to hand things over to Kari Hedlund for Headwaters. Tonight. So it is dark out, so maybe that's why I thought it was tonight. But, you know, we all know it's morning. If you're hearing this, I'm sure you're well aware it is morning time. It is 6:29. 6:30 right on the dot. And later in the show, we're going to be talking about Clue, the upcoming Bemidji Community Theater production. I had a conversation with the director of the production, Derek Hull. And spoiler alert, I am in Clue. I am Professor Plum. So it's nice to kind of talk with my director about our upcoming show that begins this weekend and goes into next weekend. So that'll be coming up. And I know just a bit, I'll be joined by Jennifer Barr, and we'll be your hosts this morning. It's time to get rid of that old car, truck, or boat before you're stuck with it all winter. KXC's Cars program makes it quick and easy, and will even tow it away for free. The proceeds from your unwanted vehicle become fuel for your favorite community radio station. Visit kaxc.org/cars to get your car donation started, or call Heather at 218-326-1234 for more info. And looking at the weather today, it's going to be mostly sunny but cold. Highs 1 to 5 degrees, wind chill values 25 below to 28 below. Northwest wind 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with lows 12 to 14 below. Thursday, partly sunny with highs 3 to 6 degrees, light and variable wind. Evening lows 12 to 17 below. And Friday, sunny, highs 6 to 7 degrees. Evening lows 10 to 13 below. So it's going to get cold again, but not as bad as last weekend. I don't know about you, but I had a little bit of trouble this past weekend. My car wouldn't start on Friday morning, which was very disturbing seems too strong of a word, and scary seems too strong of a word. Disappointing, I guess, is the word I'm looking for. You know, like when you are already in a rush, and then when your car doesn't start, there's few things worse than that. It's just awful. But how are you going to handle the cold? You can text us at 218-326-1234. Is it about time to start going out cross-country skiing with highs 6 to 7 degrees, or is that still too cold? Would love to hear your opinion on that. That number again is 218-326-1234. And you can check out KAXE.org for the latest news from our region and our photos from a vigil at the Crow Wing County Jail in Brainerd, where there are over 40 ICE detainees. If you have a news tip, email news@KAXE.org. Now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On January 27th of last year, San Carlos Apache teenager Emily Pike went missing from a Mesa, Arizona group home. Her dismembered remains were discovered a month later in garbage bags more than 100 miles away. No arrests have been made nor suspects named. Earlier this month, a memorial in Mesa marking where Emily was last seen alive got taken down. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, it's the latest rallying cry for justice in the 14-year-old girl's unsolved murder.
Who are we here for?
Emily Pike!
Then say her name!
Emily Pike!
Say her name!
Emily Pike!
Say her name!
At the corner of Mesa Drive and McKellops Road, dozens of demonstrators met on a recent Saturday as cars drove by honking their horns.
Justice for who?
Emily Pike!
Who do we love?
Emily Pike!
Who do we love?
This is where Emily was last seen alive.
Only secrets in their diary. Girls gone missing is a national inquiry.
Since her disappearance, a chain link fence hugging the edge of a 28,000 square foot vacant lot has become home to a roadside memorial for the slain Apache teen. Visitors from near and far have flocked to this bustling intersection, adorned with flowers, stuffed animals, a banner of Emily's face, and lots of red ribbons. That was until someone suddenly took everything down earlier this month. No matter who did it, Jolene Shorty is still upset.
You took down her stuff. There is a respectful way. There is a traditional way to let things go. This is not the way.
For Shorty, she says this is the second tragedy to happen there.
I see a clean slate to start over. In a way, they almost helped us. We're going to come back and put up more stuff. We're going to honor them the way we're supposed to.
Delvina Charlie, who is Dene, thinks taking down those mementos adds insult to injury.
This is the respect that we got. We're pushed to the side that our voices meant nothing, that she meant nothing. If this was a different privileged girl, it would have been handled differently.
Since the items were taken down, Emily's family has been in talks with the city of Mesa on planting a tree and placing a bench at Fitch Park, just a few blocks from her last known location. Jared Marquez is San Carlos Apache and treasurer of the Turtle Island Women Warriors.
I've been there, being a 13-year-old kid, never talking to my parents, running around on the reservation, you know, nobody ever truly caring. And it's hard to think what this girl went through, a lot of us could have been through.
As for the investigation into Emily's murder, KJZZ asked the FBI, the Bureau of Indian Affairs Missing and Murdered Unit, and the lead agency, Gila County Sheriff's Office, for the status, but did not receive any updates. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio reporting from Mesa.
The National Congress of American Indians and the Native American Rights Fund are hosting a webinar titled Know Your Rights, followed by Q&A on Wednesday to provide practical guidance for tribal citizens on interactions with ICE. The organizations say it's in response to growing concerns from across Indian country. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kohonic Broadcast Corporation, funded by the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle. In just a bit, we are going to hear about the U.S. population growth slowing down and the future of the psychiatry's Bible. So that'll be coming up in just a bit. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a magazine showcasing the beauty, landscapes, and people of Lake Country. The February-March issue publishes the winners of their annual photo contests, which are also displayed at the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. Submissions accepted all year round at lakecountryjournal.com. And support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. So something I've been wondering about is something that popped up in my mind these past couple days is birdhouses. And when I was a kid growing up, it seemed like a common occurrence to make your own birdhouse. And I'm just curious if that was a universal experience. It seems like as a kid, at some point, you need to make a birdhouse. I made at least two that I can remember. One as an early child just at home, and then one for Boy Scouts later on. So I want to hear from you, the listener. Did you ever have to make a birdhouse? Was that something you did as a kid? I'd love to hear from you. 218-326-1234. I'm just curious if that was a universal experience or it just happened to happen to old little Andrew. Love to hear from you. Now we're going to hear more from Morning Edition.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The Trump administration's immigration crackdown is putting the brakes on U.S. population growth. The Census Bureau has just released its annual population estimate. It shows that there were nearly 342 million people living in the country last summer. Now, that sounds like a lot of people, but that means that the population is only growing about half as fast as it was a couple of years ago. NPR's Scott Horsley is with us to tell us more about this. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Michelle.
So how big of a slowdown are we talking about?
Well, the Census Bureau says the population added 1.8 million people in the 12 months ending last July. And the lion's share of that growth, more than 70%, was from immigration. But immigration added less than half as many people during that 12-month period as it did during the previous year. You know, the Trump administration's been closing off pathways for people to enter the country, either legally or illegally. And at the same time, we've seen more immigrants leaving the U.S., either voluntarily or through deportation. Keep in mind, the Trump administration was only in power for about half of the 12-month period covered by this census report. The other half was the end of the Biden administration. If the Trump crackdown continues, census forecasters say, by next year, we could see immigration drop by another 75%. Jed Kolko is an economist at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, who used to oversee the Census Bureau.
Those projections imply immigration somewhere in the 300,000 range, and that would be even lower than the lowest point of the pandemic.
Now, other than immigration, the other source of population growth is what's called natural increase, that is, births minus deaths. That's also been dropping. You know, women are having fewer children. Baby boomers are getting older. Last year, births outnumbered deaths in the U.S. by only about 500,000. Now, there was an even bigger drop during the pandemic, which caused a temporary spike in the death rate. But if you go back to years just before the pandemic, the natural increase in population was more than twice as fast as it is now.
So, Scott, your focus is economics. And how does a slowdown like this affect the economy?
Look, population growth is one of the fundamental ways to grow the economy. The Trump administration likes to argue that having fewer immigrants will mean less competition for native-born Americans if they're looking for a job or looking for an apartment, for example. But a lot of economists think that's overly simplistic. You know, immigrants are an important part of the workforce. They're also important customers for a lot of businesses. And Kolko notes newcomers typically add a lot of economic vitality.
The slowdown in immigration risks lowering the rate of innovation and entrepreneurship, which immigrants disproportionately contribute to.
Falling immigration is likely one reason that job growth slowed sharply over the last year. And when there are fewer people working for every retiree, that puts a bigger strain on the finances of Social Security.
So what does this week's report tell us about where the U.S. population is growing?
Yeah, the Census Bureau not only tracks movement in and out of the country, but also from state to state. And the report generally shows more growth in the more affordable parts of the country, like the South and the Midwest, while costly coastal areas are losing population. The general trend, though, of a downshift in population growth is visible all across the country. States that are growing more slowly than they used to, and states that are shrinking are losing population more rapidly.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
The American Psychiatric Association says it's making some changes to what's often called the Bible of psychiatry. Officially, it's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM. The next edition will be very different than the current one. NPR health correspondent Ritu Chatterjee has been reading. Hi there.
Hi, Steve.
What is this manual used for?
The DSM, it lists and defines all the mental health disorders that are recognized by the American Psychiatric Association, and it's key to diagnosing patients. Here's Dr. Jennifer Havens. She leads child and adolescent psychiatry at NYU Grossman School of Medicine, and she says the manual is so important to treating patients.
Because the essential thing you have to do in any illness is diagnose it. And if you make the right diagnosis, you prescribe or initiate the right treatments.
And those diagnoses and treatments are updated in the DSM every 15 years or so to reflect scientific advances. And the current version, the DSM-5, came out in 2013. Now, they haven't decided if this next version will be called the DSM-6 or something else.
But let's get to the substance here. Why would they need to change it, and what are they changing?
So there's a lot of scientific advances that need to be reflected. And one big change that's going to happen is that the next version will be a living document published online instead of being this big, heavy printed book format. And that's so it can be updated more frequently to reflect scientific advances. For example, as scientists find new biological markers like blood tests to diagnose and treat different subsets of mental illnesses, they will get included. And many of the other changes, Steve, will address some of the common criticisms of the current DSM. Here's Dr. Maria Oquendo. She's the chair of the strategic committee working on this, and she was speaking at a press conference last week.
There are many critiques out there, and perhaps the most salient one is the fact that the DSM doesn't reference what the causes of mental disorders are.
Oh, well, that's really interesting, because don't you need to know the cause in order to treat something frequently?
That's exactly right. Dr. Havens at NYU, who isn't involved with updating the DSM, She says that when you don't take into account underlying causes, you risk prescribing inaccurate treatments. Take, for example, the role of psychological trauma, anything from, you know, childhood abuse, maltreatment, or a car accident that threatened your life.
Trauma causes a significant amount of the mental illness that we see in everybody. And it increases the vulnerability of people who are going to have serious, persistent mental illness like schizophrenia tremendously.
And that's something she says that psychiatry hasn't always taken into account historically. But this next version of the DSM will include factors that we know cause mental illnesses like people's environment, their socioeconomic conditions, cultural identities, life experiences. And Haven says that this would be a sea change in psychiatry.
So where does this update go from here?
The psychiatrists are putting their overall strategy out into the world for healthcare providers and people living with mental illnesses for their feedback. They want this next version to be informed by a wider circle of people than just psychiatrists.
Oh, interesting. And having this digital version will make it easier to update with what they learn. Ritu, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
You are listening to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle, and I'm joined now by Jennifer Barr.
Good morning.
Good morning. It is a little chilly out there, but it definitely doesn't feel as cold as it has been.
It's a little better.
Yeah. Feels like a heat wave yesterday.
Yeah. I think it's really going to feel warm by, especially Sunday, we're going to be in like the 20s.
Yeah, so that's going to be wild. That's like 40 degree difference from last week.
It'll feel good.
Yeah. So one thing we like to do here on the Wednesday Morning Show is looking at the national days.
All right.
Of what's the special about this day today. And I'm going to throw them out at you, Jennifer, and I want to hear what your thoughts are on these days.
Okay.
So first up, it's National Pop Art Day.
Oh,
you
I
like pop art.
I do like pop art, like Andy Warhol.
Yeah.
Roy Lichtenstein.
Yeah.
I believe. Yes, I do.
All right. So thumbs up.
Thumbs up on pop art.
How about Library Shelfie Day?
Shelfie.
Yeah, where you take a picture with you, like, by the library shelf or whatever.
Oh, that's what that
Shelfie.
Is.
Shelfie.
I've never done that.
I don't think I've ever done it either. I'd be curious to see if the libraries post their shelfies
today.
Oh,
yeah. I enjoy a library.
Yeah.
In high school, my senior year, I worked in the library for one of the class periods.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
So what would you have to do?
Put the newspapers on the big wooden sticks.
Oh.
Change those out every day. If magazines came in, you know, switch those out. I don't really remember shelving books, but maybe sometimes I did. So.
Would you have to check books out for people?
I think I knew how.
Okay.
There wasn't a lot of traffic in there.
What period was it?
Third.
So right before lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Kids are getting hungry.
Yeah.
Don't feel like reading. But speaking of hungry, it's also National Blueberry Pancake Day.
Oh, you know, this might make me really unpopular. I'm not a huge fan of blueberries.
Oh, okay.
Well,
they got so many oxides?
I don't know. It's just they're not my favorite fruit. But I will say, if they're in a muffin or like baked, cooked into the pancake, I don't mind them so much.
Mm-hmm.
But like a blueberry sauce on top of a pancake?
Blueberry sauce would never be my first choice.
No.
And I don't want like physical blueberries on my pancake either. Either it's in the pancake or I ain't having blueberry pancakes.
Right. Yeah. So I guess it would be okay. Yeah. If they're cooked in there, they're okay. But not, I'd prefer just a plain pancake or a chocolate chip pancake.
What about like blueberry favored candy type stuff? Are you out in those too?
Not my favorite.
Because they don't taste like blueberries.
No, they don't. No. Or like blue raspberry. Like, what is that?
Well, blue raspberry, that's my all-time favorite fake flavor.
Is it?
Oh, yeah.
It's one of my least favorite.
Really?
Yeah.
What about like Kool-Aid, blue raspberry lemonade?
Mm.
It's so good. I wish I had a cup right now.
Maybe. Yeah. I guess my very least favorite candy, fake candy flavor is banana.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't like Runtz?
Runtz all just tasted... Well, I guess they did have a little bit individual flavor.
Yeah.
It's like orange tasted like orange. Yeah, no, not the banana Runtz.
So Laffy Taffy banana out.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's the one that people hate the most.
Yeah.
Is the Laffy Taffy banana.
Yeah.
What's your favorite Laffy Taffy though?
A pink one?
Strawberry? Like
strawberry or something?
Strawberry is very good. I'll agree with that. All right, so our final one, Data Privacy Day. What are your thoughts on data privacy?
I'm all for that.
Yeah, I'm pro data privacy too.
Yeah.
So
it's a good thing.
I don't know how you celebrate.
Hide your data.
Yeah, hide your data. How do you? But you told me, which isn't on this list, that's National Kazoo Day.
Yeah, I had actually been ready for some of these. I was like, oh, I wonder what our national days are. And that came up a couple times on my search.
Well,
so
I don't know why it's not coming up on mine, but
let's see.
Where do you stand on the National Kazoo?
The National Kazoo. You know, in small doses, kazoos are kind of fun.
Did you ever have to play one, like, at school for, like, were you in choir?
Well, in seventh grade, I was in the official choir. But otherwise, you know, we had music class where we had to do programs and stuff. You know, it seems like something we would have done. I can't remember specifically.
We had to for one song, and I specifically remember because the school bought us kazoos for the six of us. And it was a boys, what's the ensemble?
Yeah.
That's what it's called. And we did Sweet 16,
mm-hmm.
and then half of the song is like, rawr, 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 rawr. It was, and we got a state star. It was pretty great.
Oh, very good. State star. That's impressive. Yeah, I just was searching again. National Kazoo Day is celebrated each year on January 28th, or the fourth Thursday in January, or any time around there. So I guess we're in the zone for National Kazoo Day.
Well, we're all pro-kazoo here, I think,
mm-hmm.
safe to say. So we want to hear from you. How are you going to celebrate National Kazoos Day? Maybe you don't like kazoos. We'd love to hear that, too.
I could understand if you don't.
Or library shelfie, if you've got one already. We'd love to see that.
Mm-hmm.
That number is 218-326-1234. Where do you stand on the controversial blueberry pancake? We want to hear from you. And coming up later in the show, it's going to be Area Voices talking about Clue. Are you a fan of the game Clue, Jennifer?
Yes. You know, it's not something I played really as a kid. I didn't have it. I think I played with my, I remember playing with my cousins once at our grandparents' house. Like they had brought it or something.
Okay.
And that was my first time. And I liked it a lot. And then I didn't play it until my son was little. And I like it. It's like, you know,
you have a go-to.
You got your little sheet, you're marking off who you think is where and...
Do you have your go-to character that you go with?
No. Probably the pink or purple one. Like,
there's no pink one.
Oh, yeah, maybe not.
Miss Scarlet, you mean?
Scarlet, or or Plum, like, who is your character?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, well, my son had, he had the regular Clue, and then someone gave him Harry Potter Clue.
Oh.
Which was fun.
Yeah, I never thought about Clue doing special versions of it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot now. There's like I've seen like one for The Office, like mm-hmm. the TV show The Office.
Oh.
Yeah, the Harry Potter one was fun and it had a lot of little like twists, like some of the rooms like had little things you could turn to make secret passages or not be secret passages, and then there was like in the dice there was like you know, like this bad thing would come up, I can't remember all the Harry Potter stuff now. But anyway, it was a little different than the traditional Clue.
So I remember playing it as a kid and loving it because my sister got it for Christmas one year. And I remember because we would open presents Christmas Eve. And then Christmas Day before everyone woke up, my mom and my sister and I played Clue.
Mm-hmm.
And I had such a great time. And then played it on and off for like the next few years or whatever, whenever my sister wanted to play, I guess. And then didn't play it again until I was 22, and I was like, man, this game is not as exciting as I remember. And it was a bad wake-up call, you know?
Yeah. Well, I like it.
So we want to hear from you. Let us know what you think about Clue. 218-326-1234. We're going to play a tune for you. This is a new one from Iron and Wine. This song is called In Your Ocean.
Dry ground, though I only want to drown when I find myself swimming in your ocean. I've been fighting for light when the moon is full and bright. You can laugh, but I take it as a token. Praying for dry. It's where you've been and why you're in the way. Never what you want, but how much you can take. Lonely wave toward the shore, lonely sparrow singing for its lonely world. It's lonely.
And that was Iron and Wine with the song In Your Ocean. Iron and Wine, I think, kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't think he gets the proper recognition for kind of starting a certain wave of music.
Oh.
Like I don't know if there would be, Bon Iver would have gotten as popular if Iron and Wine wasn't like the first like kind of slow acoustic, more indie rock sound. But I remember my first time hearing Iron Wine was because of his cover of Such Great Heights for the Garden State soundtrack.
Oh, okay.
But, and then that kind of, you could use that song as like the kickoff of like branches. And then Freak Folk happened and then it all just went all over the place.
Right.
Iron and Wine, new album coming out called Hen's Teeth here on the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle here with Jennifer Barr.
Good morning. My first morning show in Bemidji.
How does it feel?
It feels good.
Not too cold in here?
No, it's just right. Warmer than the drive over.
Excited about the From the Vault segment?
Yes.
You get to see it in person?
Yes.
And we got our wonderful plant selection here. A lot going on today.
Mm-hmm.
We received support from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com.
And we also thank Woodworks Homes, dedicated to the art of building in northern Minnesota by constructing handcrafted new homes and offering remodeling services. More at woodworksmn.com.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Power.